you could learn how to be a good football quarterback. That doesn't mean you're going to be one. So learning is a key. That skill is certainly important. The mindset to be able to take that in is certainly important, but then you have to apply that to, am I going to be successful? Can I throw a football that long? And can I hit the target?
There will always be somebody stronger, faster, and smarter than you. Surviving depends on your adaptability to change. Those who are the most adaptable are dialed in.
Is a self-proclaimed executive, co-founder, mentor, worker, advisor, science geek, you name it, has a strong history of entering situations where management discipline is needed in order to create growth in startups or stability in more mature organizations. He's an advocate of research and innovation who speaks to and from the technology and security industries. He has an extensive experience in building and leading high-performance teams by identifying and developing high-potential leaders at all levels of an organization, many of whom who achieve world-recognized leadership status, injecting intelligence into risk management. Let's bring out Jeff Reach. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the show. Are you ready to get dialed in?
I'm ready to be dialed in, Kyle.
Hey, Kyle here. Quick interruption. The audio is kind of funky here with this echo sound, but it clears itself up about 4 minutes in. So be patient or fast forward to that 4 minute mark and everything sounds a million times better. Also, a classic example of me butchering someone's last name again. It's Jeff Rich, not Jeff Reach. Let's do it, man. So let's talk about this. Injecting intelligence into risk management. What is going on here?
So... to answer the question as to what's going on, there's a whole lot going on. But specifically, when I talk about injecting intelligence, you could apply that to other disciplines in addition to risk management, but it's been lacking in risk management for a very long time.
All right, right. So what is risk management? Break it down for us.
So risk management, simply put, is determining what sort of risk appetite you have. Everything you do has risk associated with it. Whether it's doing this podcast, getting out of bed in the morning, walking across the street, all of those have risk associated with it. And you, whether it's subconscious or not, manage that risk. You determine how much risk you're willing to accept, and you focus on how much, what controls are in place, and then you execute according to your risk appetite and that risk management decision.
Got it. So injecting intelligence. So we're coming from the stature that there needs to be more intelligence in the category of risk management then.
Absolutely. Because the people that are focusing on risk management, which includes security and a whole bunch of other things, are all across the spectrum of individuals. On one side, you have hardcore security geek who says, I want to buy every single piece of hardware and firewall and data leak protection and everything I could possibly get and turn on every ritual. And I imagine you've all seen at least one person like that. I used to be that guy a very long time ago. And then on the other hand, you have people that say, no, that gets in the way of my business. Put a hole in the firewall for me. I don't care. And that can apply to any technology. So across that spectrum, intelligence is injecting intelligence gets us towards the center, which is where we need to be.
Okay, got it. So risk management, so you are the COO, the Chief Operating Officer at Service currently, and you've served many other positions with respect to supply chain, logistics, and just IT in general, right? So let's kind of, where's the intersection there for you?
So the intersection for me actually goes a lot deeper than that, because I've background in science and education. Oil and gas industry, and then the hosting industry, financial services, and without getting into specifically the specific company I work with, but I've been able to cut across all of those disciplines over time and learned through mentors and people that helped me along to be able to talk about what needs to be done and how we're going to do it. And simply put, I only found success when I was able to get into the head of the business, figure out what's important, and then apply what makes sense to that.
Got it.
You can dive into that more if you want. But...
Yeah. Let's tell me more. Tell me some context about your background. Share some more about your background for all of us.
So a couple of things. I was born and raised in the Northeast, Massachusetts, moved to Texas, spent a little time with EDS actually, and then worked for Arco Oil and Gas Company. And one of the first things I did was make a presentation to a bunch of guys that have mainly native Texans and had some of whom have been working at the company for over 30 years already. And I made a presentation. I thought I had great slides and I talked and I got through everything I wanted to. And at the end, the senior guy came up to me and put his hand on my shoulder and said, "Son, you need to learn how to slow down." And what he got across here wasn't that I had to slow down. More importantly, what he was saying is you didn't know your audience. You came out with what you thought was working, and you never confirmed that the audience was ready to receive that in that way. Now, that's not what he said, but that's what ended up being the truth behind it. So let's start with that. From that, I grew into, instead of saying because I was building a security program there, instead of saying let's lock everything up, I really had to focus on how do we protect what's important the most. Mm-hmm. And that really makes sense, I think, going forward. It's always going to come back to how do you inject intelligence? Intelligence doesn't mean you have to have an IQ of 180. In fact, I'm not even certain that helps. But intelligence does mean what's your situational awareness? What are you gathering about what's around you? And what are you taking in for that? And how are you applying it to your expertise so that you can make it work?
No, right. No, that's powerful, right? And when you can do that, it really shows. Tell me about organizations you've been at and kind of how that's played out for you.
So it's grown in a few ways. I spent quite a bit of time at Arco, went from there to Dell to start the security program there, and very different. Dell at the time was in the 90s, just gone public and was a manufacturing company. Even though they manufacture computers, they were more manufacturing than they were technology. Mm-hmm. Obviously, a lot of that has changed about Dell since then. And since I left, I spent some time after that with a few hosting companies, Interland, Rackspace, Layer Technologies, and EngineYard. And in each of those, had the opportunity to build a program from scratch, or in one case, take a program that had been started but really wasn't working and say, let's remodel it and let's make it grow. And the reason I like being able to do that is I can come in and say, let's not just lock everything up. Let's figure out what's important. I've also done some consulting, and that's where I've really gained most of my insights on this. Because when I come in on a consulting opportunity, obviously, often the customer will say, I want you to protect this or that. Mm-hmm. And I'll always come back with, okay, that probably needs protecting, but what do you have that's important and where is it? And how important is it? I've never had anyone answer that question with anything other than, and what I figured out is if they knew that answer, they wouldn't need me because they would know what to protect and how.
Hence, injecting intelligence into risk management, right? So how do we actually do that? Like what are you proposing?
So what I propose is for all of technologists, whether it's security or not, to take some time to get your head out of the motherboard. All right, it's a phrase I use about that because it. You can usually get the image. Get away from the computing for a bit. Get away from the technology a bit, because the technology, unless you're a pure technology play company, but even then, the technology is simply a tool for the business to achieve what it wants to achieve. And when you look at it that way and not make it the end all or the best thing possible or that you couldn't possibly have your business without me, and instead say, what is the business? How are we going to succeed? You can then figure out what tools do I need to use. If you can't figure that out, your successor will.
Right.
Or the business goes away, because the business can't survive if technology drives it. The business only thrives and succeeds when the business goals are met by using technology.
I love that line you said, get your head out of the motherboard. For any IT professionals watching right now, like that's a pretty crucial part in this, right?
Absolutely. And whether it's in a physical device or in a virtual machine or in the cloud, you have to take a bit out and not catch cloud, of course, but you have to take yourself out of the situation of what should technology be doing, and focus instead on what do we need to do as a business and how can I make technology work for it?
Right. No, absolutely. So, you know, on this show, Dialed In, we talk about being the most adaptable to change, right? And it's not necessarily about being the smartest or the fastest or the strongest, but just being the most adaptable. Like, that really sums up what a lot of this is for success for a lot of individuals, right? So what does that mean to you, and what role does that play in your world of being adaptable?
So I think being adaptable is crucial to survival as well. I remember when client-server technology was considered new back in the 80s, right? And there were people I worked with that said, they'll never get the data off the mainframe. Client-server is never going to work. Yeah, well, that didn't catch on, that philosophy. And what I would often say to them is that you're soon going to have the reverse imprint of a front of a train on your face, because you're standing right on the track and it's going to barrel right through you. And those that really disagreed strongly, not that I had all the answers, but those that strongly disagreed retired soon after. And perhaps that was the right time for that. But those that didn't would embrace whatever new technology there is, even if that wasn't the right technology going forward, by being able to say what's going on now, what's current, what can I be involved in? You keep yourself current, first of all. But you also provide the best tools for your business environment, which is why you're there. You want to provide the right support and tools. I often surprise people, not because of everything I know or whatever, because I don't really think that body of knowledge is necessarily that great. But I can touch a lot of new technologies that people get completely surprised that I even know about. Most people assume, first of all, that I probably own a flip phone. That's the first thing I encounter, just by people looking at me. All right. And there's nothing wrong with a flip phone. So if you have a flip phone, I'm sorry. Although, what are you watching this on?
Wow.
But more importantly, not only do I not have a flip phone, and I'm not an expert in all new technologies, and I'm never going to claim to be, but I can touch most of them. And that surprises people when I say, oh, yeah, I know that, or here's what I'm doing with that. And it's usually someone in their early 20s will say, oh, how'd you learn about that? And it's probably the same way you did. I listened and looked and gave it a try. So to me, that's the fundamental the foundation for being adaptable is, hey, what's out there? Can I make this work for me? I've now adapted. Waiting for someone to show you how to adapt isn't being adaptable. And therefore, you could never blame anyone else for you not adapting.
Do you think it's more of a mindset issue or like a skill issue? Like, is like being able to learn, that is actually a skill in itself. Like, hey, I'm able to learn. Like, that's actually kind of a skill that we learn. We learn how to learn, right?
Yes. And everyone, no matter where you are on any spectrum, has a capability of learning. Now, you need to know what your own constraints are. For instance, you could learn how to be a good football quarterback. That doesn't mean you're going to be one. So learning is a key. That skill is certainly important. The mindset to be able to take that in is certainly important, but then you have to apply that to, am I going to be successful? Can I throw a football that long? And can I hit the target? And no matter what you learn about it, if you can't do that, you're not going to be a good professional quarterback.
Wait, Jeff, can you repeat that line again? Just a summary of the quarterback line.
So if you learn how to be a quarterback and you know everything that has to happen and you gain that skill, you still have to recognize your constraints may prevent you from being a professional quarterback. So can you really throw the ball that far? Can you hit your target every time? If you can't, you're probably not going to be a good professional quarterback.
That's great. That's a great analogy. I love that one. Let's see. We had a comment too. Aaron, appreciate you, man. He said, get out of the motherboard, focusing on what the technology should be doing for the business and being adaptable, helpful perspective for other job functions too. Awesome. So Jeff, you know, in your current role, CEO, Chief Operating Officer for Service, what would you say is the biggest challenge with your role right now?
Oh, so we're a startup and we're rolling out our first customer in the very immediate future. So right now, my biggest challenge is finding everything that's rolling off the table and trying to catch it before it falls. Along with the rest, I'm not the only one doing that, obviously. But there aren't that many of us. You know, there's about five of us really that are focusing on let's drive to this, getting the customer on board and getting the customer two and plus. And, you know, there's everything from operating principles to some general policies that we are implementing to say, hey, here's how we operate. We're defining through demonstration what our values are. In one example there, you know, someone said, hey, why don't we come up with a list of our values and then focus on that? And I said, no, don't make a list of values. Let's observe what we do. Those are our values. And if we don't like them, we can make an effort to change. But every time, you know, I've worked at a number of companies where they say, let's go have an offsite, you know, for the senior people and define what the company values are. And I've often found that doesn't really work. They become a list of words that people feel obligated to follow, but they aren't necessarily a demonstration of how you act. So that's one thing we're focusing on. Who are we and how do we act? How do we treat people? How do we treat customers? How do we treat vendors? And I think that's very important. We also have a small development team involved in some testing. Here and there, I poke a finger in to say, can we do this or do that? I'm careful not to say, let's make this work differently, because I'm not the developer here, and I get that. I'm also managing, you know, getting in what we do for personnel management and our sales pipeline and a CRM and our budget and what we're doing for fundraising. And is that a long enough list?
Yeah. No, I love what you said about, like, don't make a list of words. Like, these are our values and stick them up on the wall. But rather observe what you guys are actually doing, and that becomes your values. But then after you observe what you're doing, then do you turn that into a list or no?
Yeah, I think that can make sense, because you should be able to distill from that the things that work. Do we really enjoy and demonstrate being honest and transparent? If we do, then I think that's a phrase that can be part of our values. If we're not demonstrating that, then it shouldn't be up there until we know we can demonstrate it.
Oh, that's very wise right there. Yeah, I mean, I think so many of us get that backwards. Then we're like, these are what we think we have to do, and that's what we're gonna put up there. And then, you know, you try to force yourself into that box, right?
Yeah, and that also hurts hiring, by the way, when you make that list in advance in an arbitrary manner, even if the senior people think it's the right list, and some of them may be, but. If I'm going to hire someone, I want to make sure, first of all, that their values match the people we have so far, or at least the group they're going to work in. Mm-hmm. So we have to observe what those are, and values from different groups may be different as well. The values for sales may be slightly different than the values that the developers demonstrate. And I'm not a fan of saying we have to merge them. They may be two complementary sets. So not only do you want to demonstrate support of the values, but we also want to identify the skills everyone has, so that what we're not hiring is just another duplicate of someone we already have, because one of them isn't needed. You can ask anyone I've reported to, and I've always gone by the rule that if you and I always agree, one of us doesn't need to be here. So most people I report to know that me disagreeing with them is not something I'm afraid to do.
Nice. No, I love it. If you or I neither agree or disagree, one of us doesn't need to be there. I love that. Yep. Mm-hmm. So what would you say is, you know, throughout all of our, like, history and careers, like, we experienced micro failures throughout our history, and, you know, we learn from those failures, and it's okay. So what would you say is, like, one of the biggest failures you've experienced that you remember most, and kind of what you took from it?
So I'm going to redact it, and it wasn't a micro failure. So can I still talk about it?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I'm being generous. I'm being kind there with micro failure. Right. But yeah, a big failure
too. I'm going to raise it up a level just so it's not really identifiable. But a situation existed where I observed some behavior serendipitously. I was working on an issue that I was pursuing, and I happened to come across someone displaying some behavior. I'm really making this generic. And it's something that, you know, they probably shouldn't be doing that. So that caused me to, I don't leave any stone unturned. That caused me to look into a bit and realize, there's a couple of people involved in this, and none of them should really be doing this. It doesn't support our corporate values. That was one thing. But another is, I'm not certain it isn't breaking the law. So the mistake I made, even though from a morality perspective, you can say, gee, I did the right thing by looking further into it and kind of turning over some of the rocks associated with it and uncovering some information. What I didn't do was judge the temperature of the company well enough and where we were in our corporate growth to see if this was the right time for them to be ready to accept this and deal with it. And they weren't. So even though out of context, I did all the right things, the lesson I learned was I never really took the temperature of the company. Not that I should have delayed it, but sometimes turning over information that people don't want to hear, sometimes you have to focus on when is the right time for them to hear it. Because if they hear it at the wrong time, they're not going to be able to deal with it effectively.
Oh, wow. No, that's a wise lesson there.
Yeah, that was a painful one.
Sounds like it, man. Sounds like it was. What would you say is like the, you know, besides injecting intelligence into risk management, what would you say like is the biggest area of focus that you're curious about right now?
So what I'm most curious about right now happens to be what service is focusing on, which is why I'm there. Mm-hmm. And it's supply chain. And it's not, you know, how can we manage a supply chain? How can I do procurement faster? Those are all results of supply chain issues. But most importantly, whatever you consume as a consumer, whether it's a phone or a carrot or this microphone or whatever you're consuming, right now, it's almost impossible in most cases for you to have visibility all the way up to supply chain to see the true source of the material or materials that you're consuming.
Right. Okay.
As a result, let's go back to a current example. How did you feel about your toilet paper supply in March?
Didn't have enough.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, that's how we felt, right?
Yes. Yeah. So everyone felt I need to go buy three cases. And I'm not sure why, because I never heard any indications that the virus caused any sort of issues requiring more of that. But that's another decision there, another discussion. But more importantly, that happened. And the stores, that empty shelves, wherever TP was, you know, the week before. And the suppliers said, I just can't keep up enough. Now, there was an increased demand. The biggest issue we had, though, is no one had visibility up to the tree, which is really the source, right? Mm-hmm. No one had visibility up to the tree, except for the loggers and the people maybe one degree away from them. So without that, we lose efficiency. We lose money. We, for a number of reasons, whether it's loss or inefficiency or theft, you know, shrinkage or pillage or whatever else is going on, there's a whole bunch of money, efficiency, and product lost along that supply chain. And guess who pays for that?
We do, right?
Yeah, the consumer does, because every time any part of that supply chain has a loss, they'll pass that along. Now, I'm not against anyone in a supply chain. I get why that happens. But the problem is eventually you reach the consumer, which is the end of the supply chain. And like, well, here's what the difference is. Thank you very much for paying all for all the losses we had all the way up the chain. So, by the way, there's a risk management issue there as well. When you look at the security of supply, now toilet paper was a good example to use this year because it's still relatively fresh. And in some cases, maybe a lot in everyone's mind. But let's go back to chips that you have in your computer. And let's say you're going to be using those computers to work on new R&D for your company, or maybe you're working on it for a project that you want to propose to the Department of Defense. It's anywhere in there, something that's obviously important, valuable, and you don't want leaked out. Do you know all the components in your computers? And do you know if any of them possibly have, do you suspect that any of them could possibly send some of your information out without your knowledge? You probably don't. Now, I don't recommend taking the computer apart and trying to examine it. But what you should be able to do is go up the supply chain, and here's another opportunity for injecting intelligence. Don't be a fascist about it, but go up the supply chain and say, can you identify, the provenance, everything you have and where it came from? And if not, can you work with your next component up the supply chain to see if they know? At some point, everyone knows, but no one yet has done the work it takes to say, show me all of that.
So that's interesting.
So that's my current concern.
Jeanette has a question. Thanks, Jeanette. She said, Jeff, this is related to supply chain. Have you been able to find an alternative supply path? Are they being overburdened used because everyone is running down the same path?
So good question. To unpack it, there's a couple of questions in there, which is good. There's two question marks as well. So to define alternative supply paths, the answer simply is yes. I don't have a source for toilet paper for you, if that's what the question was, but there aren't many opportunities where you can't find an alternative supply path for what you're doing. You just have to be able to go out and look, and don't look when you're panicking because you're out. The time to look is before. The second thing is, are they being overburdened and overused? The answer to that is yes. Some paths of the supply chain are overburdened, only because the alternate paths are not. And there's a number of reasons why the alternate path may not be used. People may not know about it. The supplier may not want to get into that yet because they're worried about their supplies, because they may not be able to see up the supply chain. Or it appears to not meet your requirements, even though if you look at your requirements differently, they may. So I think it is, to your last point, mainly because everyone is running down the same path, and everyone's so focused on running, they're like racehorses, and they have blinders on, and they know that's where they want to be, but they don't bother looking to the side.
Oh, wow. Interesting. So I know we're bouncing around a lot here, but one of the focuses of the show is like getting into career path and mentorship and mentoring of others. So could you maybe share a time that, that's kind of been an impact in your life, either mentoring or being mentored by someone?
So I can go back earlier than most of your viewers have been alive and go to a mentor I had when I was in school, going for my degree, and I worked part-time in the college police and security department. And the chief there was one of my early mentors. And suffice to say that he found me in a situation that could have taken a different path based on our engagement. But he gave me an opportunity to say, that's not what you have to do. You could just do this instead. And I ended up working with him. And I gained a lot from that, worked hard, gained a lot of experience and a lot of wisdom from him. Had a lot of fun with him too. And when I left, I said, you've done a lot for me. What can I do to pay you back? And his answer was, as you go through life, find someone that doesn't deserve your help and give it to them. And that really stuck with me because it was clear that's what he did with me. I didn't deserve his help. And he was far from being a saint, trust me.
One second there, Jeff. That was incredible. So if you find someone that doesn't deserve your help, that's when you give them help. That's the takeaway here, guys. So go back and listen to that, replay that. That's incredible. No, I love that. And so you've put that into practice, right? Throughout your history. And what have you kind of seen from that?
So I do try to do that all the time. Some of the results, some of the measurable results are some of the people that I either brought into the information security field or joined working with me after they were already in it, had opportunities to help open some doors for them. And I'm very proud of the fact that a lot of people that I worked on mentoring and developing ended up getting CISO of the Year awards, are now CISOs for large multinational companies. CISOs for large state organizations and getting a lot of recognition for that. Now, the recognition in and of itself is not what you go for, but the fact that it's happening consistently, it makes me very proud, first of all, but it tells me that the find someone and help them philosophy still works and it should always be applied. So I would always offer that when you have a chance to do that, it'll pay, the dividends will come back multifold. And this isn't a, even though I can become philosophical, I'm going to stop myself from doing that because that's not what this is, but it really will. It's going to make you feel better and you're going to help people out. And the more you do that, the more you learn. We get back to how do you learn what you're going to do? I still teach part-time through UTSA, the Center for Infrastructure Insurance and Security. And I teach classes on either being able to achieve DFAR so you can be a federal contractor or preparation for a CISSP exam. And the reason I continue to teach this is I learn from every class that I teach because I find out what the situation is. I find out why someone's doing this. That helps me complete the picture. And I'd like to think I help them achieve their goal through the class as well.
Oh, that's incredible. So it seems like you prioritize impact in your life and with respect to what you focus on, your work on, right?
Exactly. And I'm not trying to give anyone the impression that I do nothing but good and I'm here for everyone else. That's not true. Although without doing that, my life doesn't work right.
Wow. That's good. That's good stuff. So Jeff, as we're starting to wrap up here, what is something that you would have asked, like if you were in my shoes, what is something you would have asked yourself that I have failed to ask you so far?
So that's a good question. And there's a really good reporter.
My favorite one. If I'm grasping at straws, that's my go-to.
Excellent. So we've talked about intelligence and what that might mean and learning and how you inject it and working with people and help mentoring people. What we didn't talk about, because I've talked about hiring as well, what we didn't talk about is how, once an organization is developed, who's in it, what makes it work, and who are the most important people there? And so if I could come up with a question is, who's the most important people, person in an organization, and who might be the most expendable? And I shouldn't use important, but most critical and most expendable. And this is something that bothers some people, but I'm a firm believer in the most critical individuals in an organization are those that are doing frontline work. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the most expendable are the ones at the top or the bottom, if you do it correctly, of an organization like the CEO.
Okay. Yeah, no, let's talk about this more because I think, we've talked about this before in the past, right? Of that hierarchical status, I can't even say that word, how it's flipped. We need to flip that upside down, and it should be, right? Of like CEO at the top, frontline worker at the bottom. It should be frontline worker at the top, CEO at the bottom.
Exactly. If you take that pyramid of the, hierarchy and positions and flip it and live that, there's another value that if you can demonstrate is great. Mm-hmm. Then what you're saying is the CEO's sole job is making sure that everyone in the organization have the tools, resources and support they need to get their job done effectively, because when that happens, everything runs smoothly. Mm-hmm. And the people on the front line doing that every day are the ones that need all that tool, all those tools, resources and support. And because of that, they are difficult to replace because you're getting real specialized driving towards the customer activities. Whereas a CEO, should the CEO happen to be replaced, is going to cause very likely the least amount of ripple effect, with the exception of the CEO that comes in and says, I'm going to change everything. And that once again takes out, which way is that pyramid flipped now?
Right. Yeah. And when they do that, they completely disrupt the order of the way everything, the order of serving all the other members in the company, right?
Yeah. You can still come in and say, we're going to make changes. But to come in and say, I'm going to make changes and here's how it's going to affect you. You've now taken that pyramid, put the CEO at the top again. And if you don't work soon to flip it the other way, then it's not going to work.
Yep, absolutely. Jeanette's on the same page. Take care of the crew. They'll take care of you.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Good advice, Jeanette.
Yep. So, So Jeff, what makes you feel like the most inspired or just the best version of yourself?
Well, I think I feel best about myself when I can see people that I've worked with succeed more and help me more in doing it. I'm going to give you an example right now. At Service, the CEO is someone that was an intern at a startup I was with 6 years ago. All right. Yep. Time flies. And we were together, and I like to think I've mentored him, and he feels that's happened. Not the sole mentor, and it's not that everything he knows he learned from me, but we have worked together on that. He's the CEO of this organization, and I think that's great. I love the fact that he's a CEO and I report to him.
That's awesome.
That may really sound strange, but
yeah. So you just have that connection to him then.
Yeah, of course. Now he's the most replaceable person in the company. You know, nobody heard me say that, but that doesn't mean he should be replaced. But I think it's great because he has learned and grown more than I have, and now I can learn and grow more with him.
Awesome,
and that makes me feel great.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. So if you could have dinner, I'm wrapping up here. So if you could have dinner with any three people, living, dead or alive, who would it be and why?
Well, first of all, alive would be my option.
Yeah, right.
But even if they aren't alive now, without question, it's pretty quick. Albert Einstein's number one. Richard Feynman's number two. And if you don't know who Richard Feynman is, Feynman, read any of his books. He is a theoretical physicist that can make everything sound easy. To a degree, and Lou Gehrig.
Okay, well, I got a special treat for you later that I did not coordinate, but you'll appreciate it later. What's the single best business book you've ever read or you would recommend?
Oh, boy. You know, there's one that I've been focusing on lately, I didn't prepare for this either. Everything's going to fall now, so be prepared for a crash. Right. And Rand's going to probably appreciate that. I'm promoting his book here. If you're in a startup, there's a lot of good lessons. It did just happen to be there. I didn't give it.
Can you say the book title again? Sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Lost and Founder. I'll put it back up again as well.
Yep. Lost and Founder by Rand Fishkin.
Yes.
Okay, cool. Just for the podcast listeners.
Yeah. He was a founder of Moz. If you're, in any case, the reason I like the book, and I can pick any, I have shelves behind me and in front of me with books in them. I can choose any one and say that the reason it's here is I like it. But what applies to me now, especially in startups, there's a bunch of lessons in there that really go to find a way to get your ego out of the way, because every time your ego sneaks in, it's going to nail you in a startup and it's not going to help you out. And there are too many arrogant people in startups, in my opinion. So I think it's a good read for that reason. He is very open and transparent with, here's what we did wrong, and boy, we really screwed up doing this, and here's what we learned.
Awesome. Love it. And Jeff, you've already dropped tons of words of wisdom on us, but in summary, like the last question for you, what is like the one piece of parting advice that you would give to everyone out there watching today?
Listen and take what you hear into your head, into your heart, and then take action because of it.
Thanks for listening to Dialed In. This show is brought to you by Acuerdo.io, the world's first orchestration agency for the future of work. Go check us out at Acuerdo.io. This show could also not be put together without great partners, Robin Austin and Casey Yarbrough of Elevate Exchange, membership for IT leaders. And remember, to win in life, to win in business, to win in your career, it's not about being the strongest, the fastest, or the smartest, simply about being the most adaptable to change, the most dialed in.